Hope you're enjoying your lunch. Thanks very much for joining us today at the FCC. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm a journalist with Reuters and the president of the club. Before we get on with the usual housekeeping notes, we've got a lot of calls coming into the FCC over the last few days, and I'm wondering if anyone has seen a Mr. Edward Snowden around, because people have been asking from overseas. I looked around the main bar, but so far, no luck. So let me know if you see him. Just a reminder, though, to please switch off your mobile phones as we're recording today's session. And let's get on to the main event of the day. Joe Studwell, who is here, live and in person, not gone missing. Many of you know him from his writing for many different newspapers and magazines. He is also the founder of Dragonomics, the founder of the China Economic Quarterly, and he will be here to talk to us today about his new book, How Asia Works. Very interesting timing to talk about Southeast Asia. The markets are really falling again today. A lot of worries that we're in for another financial crisis in the region. So, Joe Studwell, maybe you can give us a hint on that as well.
Thank you very much. I have contributed on the markets thing. I have been going around doing a lot of work for banks for the last 5 weeks and saying to them that Southeast Asia is a crisis waiting to happen. But we can get to that later. This is really about the new book. And Iris Murdoch, who was a very good English novelist, once said that people who want to meet the author of a book is like people who like pate wanting to meet the duck. Well, here I am. Your duck is here. But in the end, you've got to read the book. And I think I've written a not too bad book. It's the product of 23 years of running around the region, not all of them spent in bars. And, you know, man liao jie, yeah? You start to understand. So we only have about 25 minutes of me talking and then some Q&A. So I think, really, I should just try to tell you what the book is about, because you need to make a decision as to whether you want to read this book. Have I got, just for the journalists, I've got a map. And when I framed this book, I said, I think that I can tell the story of the 9 major economies in East Asia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, mainland China, Vietnam, Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Thailand. I think I can tell that story and the story of why they were all similarly poor at the end of the Second World War, and they now range between $3,000 and $40,000 GDP per cap. I think I can do that in 250 pages. I've done it in 240 pages, but of course there's always a scam. There are 70 pages of endnotes referencing all the academic literature, which I think supports what I'm saying. But I've managed to do it because it really comes down to 2 major structural considerations and then a 3rd prerequisite in terms of what you need to develop successfully or what you won't have if you don't develop successfully. The most basic point of this book is that if you are running a developing country, you will be successful by getting the most out of your human capital, your people, when skills are low. All right? Poor countries have a lot of people, but they're not highly resourced. They're keen, they're eager, they're hungry, they want to get richer, but they don't really know what to do. And the state moves people around in such a way that you get the most out of your human resources, and to some extent you go around the human resource constraint. All right? What East Asia has shown the world in this extraordinary laboratory of economic development is that there are 2 tricks that can be played, and this 3rd consideration which is wrapped around them. The tricks are not really Asian inventions, but they were refined in East Asia in a way the world had never seen before, and this is what made 10% a year growth possible, sustained 10% a year growth. Number 1, land reform to produce high-yield household farming. Nobody talks about agriculture. Nobody really knows about agriculture, yeah? But the fact of the matter is that in a poor country, definitionally, 75 or 80% of the population farms, lives in rural areas. If you get agricultural policy right, you lift up 80% of the population and you provide an enormous motive force for further development. Well, the curiosity of agriculture, and this is something that capitalists and communists have failed historically to get their heads around, is that yield in agriculture is actually, in general, in inverse proportion to scale. All right, now what does this mean? It means that if you have essentially almost unlimited supplies of labor and you throw it at land, you can grow more. It's like gardening. In the book, I describe the land reforms of East Asia as essentially a transition to a gardening approach to agriculture, a gardening approach which helped to take the basic staple of East Asia, countries like China and Vietnam and Japan and South Korea and Taiwan, to produce roughly six tons on average of rice per hectare. Whereas under tenancy and scale agriculture in Southeast Asia, they produce about two on average. All right, that is one hell of a difference. Now, the return per farmer, the return on capital is low because you're throwing so many people at micro level farming. Doesn't matter. In the early stages, you just want to grow more. And that gives you your initial surplus. So if we just go back to the map, you draw a big red line with your marker pen around Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and Taiwan. Those are your land reform countries. We don't have time to go into it in a lot of detail. The original land reform was the one that Mao used to win the revolution, land to the tiller. Yeah? Join the PLA, get a piece of land. Yeah? Back in the Jiangxi Soviet in the 20s, it starts there. And it goes on. That was the motive force for winning a communist revolution, or from the American perspective, what the Americans call the loss of China. How did the Americans react to the loss of China? Like America does when things get serious. They got serious. They provided the technical advice and the support to pursue first a land reform, an aggressive land reform strategy in Japan in 45-46. Then they did the same thing in Taiwan and South Korea, or they pushed the same thing in Taiwan and South Korea after the Korean War had brought the need to do something into further focus. All done by a first generation Russian immigrant, who I talk about a lot in the book, in many ways the guy who won the Cold War, stabilized the Cold War frontier in East Asia. What happened to him? McCarthyism. They fired him in 1954. He ends up living as the next door neighbor of Diem down in Vietnam as the shit hits the fan. A philosophical guy, you know, what can you do? So agriculture is critically important. Southeast Asia had land reform programs, failed to implement them. Our friends in the Philippines, Cory Aquino, remember her? 1986, comprehensive agricultural reform law. They're still implementing it. Still haven't done it. Still implementing it. Yeah, so they had the plans, they didn't implement. So that's one. Number one. Number two, acute focus on manufacturing. All the successful countries have had an acute focus on manufacturing. Why is manufacturing so important? First of all, manufacturers are just more freely traded in the world. Yeah? Commodities and manufacturers are about 81% of world trade. And the service trade in the world has been stuck at about 19 for a quarter century. Yeah? Rich people don't want too many poor people coming to their countries to perform services. Yeah? It's a problem. Yeah, even the US, there's a limit to how many poor people they want coming in every year. Look at the stresses in the UK at the moment, the political stresses from the immigration. Of course, you know, you can do services by sending people on a visa and bringing them back, but it's all very constrained. The other practical obstacle to services, of course, is that whereas with manufacturers you put them in a container, or at least you have ever since the 1960s, and send them one way, a lot of services can be done the other way by sending a product to be serviced. But if I send my car for servicing in the Middle East, I get a cheaper service bill for the car. But by the time it's gone and come back, it's uneconomic. Yeah? It's a blocker. The final thing in manufacturing that's very, very important, I think, is that it has a very nice learning curve. It's a very flat learning curve. Yeah? You can take people who are just hungry to work but don't know anything into factories and make use of them. Where is the greatest value added in China from the last 30 years? I would say the girls who go and work in the factories. Yeah? You read Leslie Chang's Factory Girls. They're the people who've added the most value in China in the last 30 years. What did they know when they arrived at the factory? Nothing. What did they do? They can build iPads. Yeah? That's how nicely they've learned. Services, you know, you want to develop through services. There are all these hurdles. You want to develop a software industry. You can't write software. You can't write a single line of software code until you've learned the code. Yeah? You can't take that person off the street and start adding a bit of value. Manufacturing is, you can get value out of people to the extent that people send kids to work in factories. Yeah? Not advocating it, but, you know, they do. So services are just more problematic. So this focus on manufacturing is the way to absorb your rural labor force efficiently into the modern economy. Now, infrastructure is thought of normally as infrastructure. I would actually say that in these countries, infrastructure development is an extension of a manufacturing policy. You build roads, you build railways, the trains to run on, the subway systems. What are you creating demand for? Cement, steel, glass, trains, cars, stuff you're going to make. Yeah, very virtuous circle, because you also get the future productivity possibilities that you have in a country like China, which I think has the best infrastructure that any country of $7,000 GDP per cap has ever had. They have problems with the service aspects of it. Yeah, they have a train crash, but it's not because they can't build the train, it's because they can't do the signaling. But that's about the time it takes to change people. You go on the Beijing subway, the trains are great, but they can't figure out the people flow. Yeah, so you're jammed in a tunnel that's half the size it needed to be. So the manufacturing focus isn't perfect, but you're going around your human resource constraints, and it allows you to grow very fast. The third point is not a structural consideration like agriculture and manufacturing. The third point is the prerequisite. To make all this happen, you've got to manage finance. This is just very straightforward. No country in the history of the world, with the exception of a few small anomalous offshore centers, has ever successfully developed without capital controls. Okay? We don't mention it when we negotiate over TPP or WTO, but that's the historical fact. You've got to control your domestic capital to point it at your targets. You don't want to be messed about by foreign capital that has a different agenda, that comes in searching for short-term profit. You're running an industrial policy. That's about learning. Yeah? The hedge fund managers have a different agenda. They want a short-run return. Yeah, your interests are not aligned at this stage of development. Further down the road, they will be aligned. They need to be aligned. Yeah, I mean, Japan needs to realign itself, having become rich, yeah, to start making the hedge fund managers happier. If you do it too early, if you deregulate finance too early, yeah, the IMF in Indonesia, in Thailand, in the Philippines, which is the biggest IMF junkie in East Asia, the Malaysians largely followed suit, gave those countries Anglo-Saxon financial systems. Money is directed away from industry towards the consumer, towards short-term returns, stock markets, and it's very, very fragile, because it's, you know, the best performing stock market, I haven't looked at the market since I talked about this 5 weeks ago, and obviously the crash is going on. Prior to that, the best performing market was the Philippines, yeah? The best performing market in East Asia is the one with the weakest industrial base, a country on the brink of returning to the third world, yeah? What does that tell you about what rich people have been telling poor people about how to develop? So you've got to have capital controls. In terms of how you manage money, there's been no consistent way to do this, because you can do it in a number of ways. You don't really use stock markets, because stock markets are looking to reward short-term investment, and they're more a short-term efficiency consideration. But you let them grow. You let them grow in the background like the Chinese do. Keep them on a short leash and let them grow and develop and learn. What you can use is the bond market, like the Chinese are now doing more because you have more control over it, but particularly use banks. Everybody has always used banks because you can point banks at the target. But there are a number of ways to do this. I mean, the Japanese and the Koreans use central bank rediscounting. So commercial banks lend. If they lend according to state policy, which is essentially to export, and this is the export discipline that I talk about at length in the book, which anchors industrial policy by forcing manufacturers to sell in the global market and hence produce a return on the investment they're getting targeted at them by the state. But the finance aspects, the rediscounting worked in Japan and in South Korea by allowing the commercial banks to expand their balance sheets by giving them new credit against credit extended, so long as they did what they were supposed to do. Park Chung-hee in Korea had all the companies file their export returns monthly to the Blue House, just sat there looking at who can export. That's a good indicator of who I'm willing to support. You didn't have to export 100%. This isn't mercantilist madness, but you had to show that you could compete in the world market. But you don't have to do it. The Chinese and the Taiwanese have not done much rediscounting. They just have their money hose. And you pointed at different things. I mean, New Energy is one I talk about because I go and see these firms quite a lot. I mean, they pointed the money hose at the wind turbine guys, gigawatt scale wind farms in China. No one had done that before. Suddenly you've got three or four of the world's biggest wind turbine makers. Then they move the hose away from the wind guys at the moment. So they're all forced out into the international market, to the US, to Australia, Eastern Europe, to try and sell wind turbines in the international market. They're being tested. Then there are these solar guys who've grown up without much subsidy. I mean, at the provincial level, they get their cheap land or free land, they get cheaper electricity, they get a little bit of R&D capital, but it's not big money. But they've managed to grow to global scale with only that small amount of subsidy. But now there's the anti-dumping case, because they have grown to such scale. But the guys in Beijing look at this and they say, they're competitive. They've brought down the unit cost of solar power by an amount we just didn't think was going to be possible. That's why we backed the wind guys. So now, maybe we'll put a bit of money that way. This year, China, I mean, it's all a bit in flux at the moment, but it looks to me like China will do as much as 10 gigawatts of domestic subsidized solar installation. The entire generating base of the UK is 70 gigawatts. That's the scale that they can move at when they want to. So, there you are. I mean, I think that's the developmental story, is the 1, 2, 3, Southeast Asia. They didn't do the agriculture. They didn't do the land reform. In manufacturing, Suharto and Mahathir tried to run some industrial policy. They lack the export discipline. So Mahathir does Proton, only one car company. It's not competing against any other companies domestically. Then he thinks, oh, we'll have another one. And he gets Perodua, and he says, well, they can do the big cars and they can do the small cars. No domestic competition, no pressure to export. They took 70% of the domestic market because of the tariffs and the protection and everything. But the export discipline wasn't there to get them close enough to the technological frontier that they could start to export this stuff. And it's a sad story, really. It's just, you know, people will try to tell you, mainly people like the Philippine government will tell you that we're not up to it. We're racially not up to it. You know, we're not like the Chinese or the Japanese. We can't do it. I mean, the racial self-hatred in Southeast Asia, I find extraordinary. The politicians are always saying we're just not like them. But that's an excuse. It's rubbish. It's about human organization, you know, and it's a convenient excuse for politicians because they're the ones who've thrown away all those possibilities. They're the ones who took the Philippines, which had the best educational capital in the region at the end of the Second World War, and took the country backwards, yeah? Whereas in Taiwan, which had a 45% illiteracy rate in 45, yeah, they got organized. But in order not to be too hard, you've got to remember that there's just a transmission process. And I think that what I've realized in East Asia is that what economists call demonstration effects, that's a very good term for the fact that people are like sheep, yeah? Demonstration effects have just been important. The breakout people in East Asia were the Japanese. They were the guys who wrote the Meiji Charter Oath, and the fourth point was, we will go out into the world and find out how the rich guys got rich. And they did it in the 1870s. The Prime Minister was away for 2 years, going to see Bismarck, going to the States, England, and they took all the stuff, and that's how they started before 45. They just applied themselves. The transmission from them was through Park Chung-hee in Korea, who'd been in the Japanese army, into Taiwan, which was also a Japanese colony, and then it comes into China. But mixed messages, because Sun Yat-sen had lived in Japan, but of course at the same time they get the Russian, you know, in the 20s they started to think that the communism was the solution. So they got mixed messages, and there's been some very unfortunate consequences to that. But essentially the transmission process of good development policy just broke down in Southeast Asia. And the Southeast Asian countries, by virtue of their colonial legacies, were too willing to listen to white people, basically. It's that simple, you know? The IMF and the World Bank come around, it's like, what's on your shopping list? Ooh, microfinance, yeah? We'll micro loans so that poor people can set up stalls to sell other poor people stuff that they can't afford to buy, yeah, basically. But I don't blame the IMF and the World Bank either. Look at how the Chinese used the World Bank and the IMF. Kept the IMF on a very short leash. The World Bank in the 1980s, if you read Ezra Vogel's account, come here, bring the Koreans, and make them show us, yeah? And the Koreans, of course, by that time were getting rich, they were already lying, yeah? They said, oh, we think you should trade freely and let us come and do joint ventures. But the World Bank guys said, that's not actually quite how we understand that it was in their early development period. So it's about taking control. It's about taking control of your destiny. And it's also, sadly, in the world in which we live, it's about telling lies, because the epilogue of the book is called Learning to Lie. You know, you can't be honest about any of this stuff. Either people don't know the history of how their own country became rich. You know, you're a Brit who doesn't know about the Navigation Acts, or you're an American who doesn't know that the average American tariff in the 19th century was 40%. Either you don't know that, or else you're fixated on a neoclassical spreadsheet view of the world in which economics is a science and it's one size fits all. So if you want to develop, politically the lesson has been learn to lie. Do not do what Sukarno did and what Mahathir did and put your finger in Uncle Sam's eye, yeah? Because Uncle Sam will come get you, you know, you won't get any support. You don't do that. What you do is what Park Chung-hee did, what Deng Xiaoping did, and you go, oh yeah, capital control is very, very important. We're absolutely on it. Absolutely on it. And then 25 years later, when it's time to get rid of capital controls, you actually do it. Yeah? Talk it out. Yeah? Give the rich people face and get on with the job of running effective development policy. That's it.
Joe, thanks very much. I like that line, give the rich people face and get on with it. We have plenty of time for Q&A. There are microphones around the room, so please raise your hand, tell us your name and where you're from if you're with an organization. Who'd like to go first? Right here.
Hi, Joe. My name's Edith Terry. First of all, I think your book, Asian Godfathers, is the best book on Asian business by far. And I've recommended it to my students and friends. This book, however, or at least your thesis, I'm really interested. I definitely plan to read the book. But the thesis seems to me, almost exactly the same as the East Asian Miracle Report of 1993. So you argue that none of the Southeast Asians sort of followed that third principle of financial repression. Well, that's not entirely true. But the main, experience that belies this argument is South Korea, which accepted the IMF money, which was crushed by the Asian financial crisis. In your book, you talk about the role, positive and negative. In your book on Asian godfathers, you talk about the role of tycoons and the sort of the corruption, the nepotism, the networks that undergird the economies of particularly Southeast Asia, but also Hong Kong. I don't see how, I mean, to me, there seems to be a basic contradiction between the sort of the outlook in, you know, this earlier work and your current one.
No, Edith, you need to read the book, you know? And also probably reread the 93 report from the World Bank. The 93 report from the World Bank followed the 87 report, and they were frankly shameful, yeah? And I'll tell you why they were shameful. They claimed to run an economic regression, yeah? They claimed to run a model to produce scientific hard evidence to show that essentially free trade had led to the development. And do you know how they got the answers that they wanted? They put Hong Kong and Singapore in the model, yeah? They put two offshore financial centers in that group of eight, and that gave them a 5-3 victory on their model. Anyway, we won't go, but that was, to my mind, shameful. I'm not against the World Bank, the IMF. I have many friends who work for those institutions, but those reports are not the same as what my book is saying. They're more or less the opposite. And I don't think it's inconsistent with what I wrote in the Godfather's book either. It's a continuation of that story. And I think it's very telling that when I go down to Southeast Asia, I can still go see these tycoons and they sit there. I have a friend in Indonesia who's made about $3 billion out of asset trading coal in the last few years. And he sits there and he says, this is absolutely screwed up, this country, since the IMF came in. We're just digging stuff out of the ground, you know? We're not learning anything. We're not moving forward. Anyone else?
Over here.
Hi, David Lyon from the EIU. I just wanted to get your take on the IMF's recent admission of failure in a lot of its policy advice, particularly regarding Indonesia. You think they had honest motives at the time, and what do you make of their new outlook on the region?
I think that they're definitely thinking. There's been admission of wrongdoing. It was a shame for the IMF that what happened to DSK happened, in as much as he's very good at his job. Leave the other stuff aside, but he's very good at his job, yeah? But I think that they're moving forward. But it's very difficult for the rich people to tell the truth, because if you tell the truth about the nature of development, you've got to essentially accept a deferment of some of the profit that's going to be made from the economic growth. I mean, you should accept, because you don't want to trade with the Philippines, because, okay, the stock market flies and two or three hedge fund managers make out like bandits, but what's there? It's dust in your hand. You know, there's nothing there. What you want is the Philippines, with 100 million people, to be a $25,000 GDP per cap and then have a piece of that, because that's real money. But it's the short-termism that's the problem. But they've always been good people. The problem intellectually, as I see it, is just what I talk about in the book as the two kinds of economics. Charles Kindleberger, in the foreword to one of his major texts, throws out this question. He says, is it really possible that there is only one kind of economics? That's kind of a brave thing for a neoclassical economist to ask. And my answer in the book is that there's at least two kinds of economics. There's the economics of development, which requires a degree of protection and manipulation, as I described in the talk, in order to learn. It's like education. You know, when you go to school, do you come back with a paycheck at the end of the week? No, you don't. You're investing to learn. And then there's the economics of efficiency, yeah, which comes later. That's more about really making things efficient. It's not about learning. And the problem in economics has been that ever since Adam Smith came on the scene, as in my mind, and of course you can read Smith in a number of ways because he wrote a lot of stuff, but in my mind, Smith was the first great champion of the consumer and the champion of efficiency in a country where everything was a stitch-up. I mean, 18th century Britain was Walpole. You know, everything was a stitch-up. It was navigation acts. It was monopolies, oligopolies, and so on. But that's how Britain had got rich. And Smith was saying, "This, you know, the man on the street's getting screwed." What did Smith say? You know, I can't remember verbatim, but you know, it is almost never the case that businessmen are gathered together, but that there is some conspiracy against the public. Yeah? And, yeah? Well, Friedrich List in Germany was trying to figure out how to make Germany develop. So this argument that began, not directly because they're not quite overlapping, but this argument that began between the political economists on List's side and the neoclassicals on Smith's side, it's not even an argument, it's just talking past each other. Yeah, because they're talking about different problems. What the List people are talking about the problems of development, what I talked about today. Smith's talking about a fair deal and efficiency and division of labor, maximized. You see what I mean? A hell of a long answer to your question, I'm sorry.
We'll go to Simon then, and over here.
Simon Pritchard with GavCal. So in the sort of your Northeast Asian model of, I guess, sort of industry policy, manufacturing, financial repression, capital controls. Most of those countries at some point, or a number of them, have sort of ended up, as they began to get rich, having substantial financial crises, usually through some mass misallocation of capital. How, given that China's sort of the last big one in that list, what's your prognosis on China? I mean, is it...
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as to say it's inevitable that they'll have a financial crisis, but I think it's pretty inevitable that they'll have an asset bubble. Because everybody else has. I mean, but the Taiwanese had the biggest asset bubble when the Americans kicked down the door in 86, 87, because they pegged the currency against the US dollar from 1960 to 1980. I mean, think of the productivity gains, and you just keep the currency pegged. You know, I mean, no one ever talks about this. I mean, everyone goes on about, oh, look at what the Chinese are doing. The Chinese aggressively undervalued the currency. I think it was a mistake. But I mean, this is not new. But the Taiwanese had the biggest asset bubble of all. I mean, the market there went from 1.5 to 12 in 24 months, 1,500 to 12,000 in 24 months. But they didn't play out as a crisis in the way that it did in Korea and when the bubble burst in Japan. But the answer is, I believe they will have an asset bubble, because it's, you have to repress finance, but de-repression is no one's managed to do it successfully without the asset bubble, because the fact that you're controlling industry and controlling entrepreneurs and pointing them in the direction that development requires does not mean that the businessmen are happy. Yeah, the businessmen are trying, they're always trying to go around you, seeing, you know, like the Japanese firms did with the Eurobond market, and you lose control. Or look at shadow banking in China, look at the curb market in Taiwan and the curb market in Korea, which I talk about. In the end, you lose this game and the lid comes off. But how much does it matter? Well, what matters is how far have you got at the point at which you either have a crisis or a destabilizing asset bubble. If you've learned, you bounce back, like the Koreans bounce back in, you know, so quickly. And I would make one other point about Korea, which I talk about in the book, and I think it's very interesting. And I disagree here. I have an ongoing disagreement with Ha-Jun Chang on this, the Korean economist, who's a fantastic writer and a fantastic economist. I mean, he thinks that the IMF going into Korea after 97 was bad and that it'll end in tears, or at least, you know, he wrote a number of papers to this effect after the crisis. And I suspect the IMF may have actually got their timing rather pretty much right. Yeah, they went in, they changed company law, they forced the privatization of some of the banks and so on and so forth. You know, Korea's sort of come up smiling. I mean, they do have a lot of consumer debt. They've moved to that Anglo-Saxon type of structure, but people are pretty happy. The consumer's being rewarded. It's all Gangnam style up there, you know? It's, so, yeah.
We have a question in the front.
Hi, I'm Jeannie Cho Lee, a freelance writer based in Hong Kong. We're talking a lot about the different economies, but I wanted to ask you more about the political regime behind the different economies you mentioned. Would it have been possible, you're talking about all this manipulation and repression, would the same development be possible if these economies didn't have a very strong authoritarian regime or a military dictatorship as you had in Korea, and that kind of very strong non-democratic political system. Is that a prerequisite to all this development that you're talking
about? Well, I address this at the beginning of the book, and I run through the countries, and I say I can't really see the pattern, you know, because when I talk about land reform, for instance, if you look at the way that the communists did land reform very successfully, they bring the people in the village together and sit them down in a democratic group to talk about what fair distribution would be. And that's how it worked in Japan, and that's how it worked in Taiwan, and it was a bit less like that in Korea, and the land reform was slightly less good. So they used a democratic mechanism to make the land reform, to get the information. In Southeast Asia, they when they try to do land reform programs, and even now they send bureaucrats down, and people, the landowners, just pay them off. You see what I mean? It's a democratic mechanism to get the information that you require. But on the other hand, Park, I mean, what a great guy. I mean, he comes to power in 61, and the first thing he does is he locks up all the businessmen. He put the tycoons in jail. I mean, how cool is that? And he just let them sit there for a few weeks, and then they come out and he says, "Oh, we just want to. We're going to have a proper developmental strategy now." First thing is, I think we need to renationalize the banks because I need control of capital. What do you think? We agree. Yeah? And, you know, so Park did some bad stuff for which his daughter is now attempting to sort of frame an apology. And it's real, it's human, that suffering, yeah? But he did a tremendous amount for Korea, and he was also less repressive than Chun Do-hwan, who did much less for Korea. You know, he was more repressive and did less for the country. The Kwangju massacre was on his watch, yeah? He's still sitting up there in his big house, yeah? So anyway, I think the book answers your question, but it's not the critical variable.
Just a quick one for me.
I've got to take a question from Baring. You can't not take a question from Baring. Philip?
Hello. He didn't even raise his hand. Was that planned?
He did. He just goes like this. He's like bidding in an auction.
550. Hey,
Philip Baring, columnist. A bit puzzled by your scorn for Southeast Asia overall, because, yes, the Philippines, I understand, but if you look over the last 30, 40, 50 years, the performance of Thailand has been at least as good as that of the People's Republic of China in terms of the growth of economic welfare in the context of a great deal of social freedom which did not exist in the People's Republic. So I'd like some explanation for that. Secondly, I would wonder about your thesis about capital controls and import substitution and manufacturing is everything. When you look at the efforts that were made over a number of years, particularly in the 1960s onwards, in Argentina and Brazil, with absolutely catastrophic consequences, which make Southeast Asia look an amazing success story.
Okay. So, I mean, it's a good nuanced point with Thailand against China, but let's stand back and look. So Thailand's about $5,000 GDP per cap. China's about seven now, yeah? But the Chinese, you know, have been running sensible policy since 1978, whereas the Thais have been going at this since the end of the Second World War, yeah? So the Chinese growth performance is considerably superior. But you're right, the Thais have had more freedom, yeah? But not always that much. I mean, you know, and the poverty in Thailand is mesmerizing, is absolutely mesmerizing. And it's born of the failure to get agricultural policy right, and it's produced the Thai Communist Party in the north, it's produced the Muslim insurgency in the south, and the elite in Bangkok, they just don't care. They just don't care. So, I mean, you're making a nuanced point, and yeah. Okay.
To blame, you know, the Thai on the Muslim, you know, insurgency in the south. I mean, it's so wide of reality.
If there'd been a Thailand reform, and Thailand was producing 6 tons of rice per hectare instead of 2, which is perfectly capable of doing, I do not believe that there would be the poverty and the unhappiness that breeds terrorist insurgency.
What about in Tibet, then, what?
We'll have to talk this out later.
You can't make generalizations
I think that I can, because every single Southeast Asian nation has had terrorist insurgency born of rural poverty. Where did the hook come from? Where did the MPA come from? Yeah, even the Malaysian insurgency put down by the Brits was rooted in rural poverty. The Thai I mentioned, and in Indonesia, I mean, I think that the failure of land reform has a lot to answer for, but I'm very willing to talk at length about this, Philip. And what was there? There was a second question. What was the second question?
South America.
So yeah, that I think I feel sort of confident. What went wrong in Latin America was that there wasn't this export discipline. Yeah, the tariffs and the protection were there, but the firms were just selling domestically, so the product quality never got to a global level. This is what essentially the Germans realized in the late 19th century, was that if you target your subsidy at exporters, then you become, this is how, you know, firms like Siemens and AEG grew in the 19th century. This is what the Japanese did by disciplining the subsidy process through forcing exports and making people produce stuff that's globally competitive. And the Latin Americans didn't do that, and that's why their industrial policy didn't produce such good results. But it didn't fail to produce any results. I mean, we've still got Embraer, yeah? Embraer is fundamentally but I can't give you many more examples because Embraer is not the beginning, the middle, and the end, but it's a large part of what actually worked. But I think Latin America's comparable. But I mean, what I've said to people so far is one thing, and I'll argue with you at length about Thailand, but one thing I've said in doing this book is that what terrifies me about development economists is that they pretend to be development economists for 185 countries. Who can, you know, I'm already nervous arguing with you about Thailand, yeah? The other guys think that they can tell us about 185 countries, so... Anyway.
We'll leave it on that debating note and let you all take it up at 2:00. Joe Studwell, thanks very much for joining us. And just to let you know, I think Joe will be signing a few of his books for a short while after this, if you'd like to buy some and have him sign them. Joe, thank you very much.